Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Tides of History ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today.
Droplets of rain began to fall from the low clouds that hung over the Alpine Valley. Jagged ridgelines hugged the edges, almost invisible behind the steel gray sky and the falling rain. A cobbled road cut through the valley, then headed up, up, up over a ridge, into the clouds, and over a pass that led down into the next glen. Curses and shouts and bellowing oxen broke through the crashing rain. A heavy wagon blocked the road as it switched back and forth across the ridge, its wheel cracked in two by the rough terrain. A group of men struggled to lift the wagon just enough to pull off the damaged wheel. Rain soaked through their heavy woolen cloaks. Icy wind cut them to the bone. Their muscles ached from the strain of shifting hundreds of pounds of smelted silver, the load that had so overburdened the wagon and its poor oxen. This was one of a half dozen wagons in the train, all of them just as weighed down with silver. The men cursed one name as they struggled and strained. Jakob Fugger, the owner of the silver and their employer. Jakob Fugger, merchant of Augsburg, trader and banker. Jakob Fugger the Rich, the wealthiest man in Europe, creditor to emperors and popes. Jakob Fugger, financier of wars and voyages of exploration. Jakob Fugger, home safe in his counting house while these carters suffered to get his goods to market. They spat at every mention of Jakob Fugger's name. From his home in Augsburg, Fugger's reach went everywhere. Southwest to Lisbon and Madrid, north to Lübeck and Antwerp, east to the mines of Hungary, and south to the Alps, then over the Brenner Pass to Venice, where this load of silver was headed. The profits from the sale of this silver would be recorded neatly in an account book housed in Jakob Fugger's Venice outpost. Maybe they would finance the purchase of spices there in Venice to be sold on for a profit elsewhere. Maybe they would be loaned to a cardinal of the church to finance his new vanity cathedral. Maybe they would buy cannon for the emperor's newest war, or pay off a foreign prince to avoid one. Whatever the case, Jakob Fugger would find a use for those funds. But back home in Augsburg, poring over accounts and letters, Jakob Fugger wouldn't lose a moment's sleep over his carter's torn muscles or broken bones or the Alpine chill that surrounded them. Their pay and the cost of the carts were simply liabilities in a ledger. With one final heave, the broken wheel came off the cart and a new wheel went on. Shivering in the cold, rubbing at aching ligaments and soreness that would never go away, the carters cursed Jakob Fugger once more and continued up the ridge toward the pass. Around 1500, European finance was transformed. For generations, it had been an Italian specialty. But times were changing. South Germany emerged as the center of banking and the money trade. Nobody was more instrumental in that shift than Jakob Fugger the Rich. Maybe the richest man who ever lived.
Hello, my peasant friends. It's Patrick. I have some really exciting news. You can now listen to our back catalog completely ad-free, exclusively on Stitcher Premium. Plus, you can listen to every new episode ad-free, too. You can sign up now for a free month of Stitcher Premium by going to stitcherpremium.com/Wondery and using the promo code Wondery.
Hi, everybody. From Wondery, welcome to another episode of Tides of History. I'm your host, Patrick Wyman. Thanks for joining me. For most of the Middle Ages, banking was dominated by Italians. Genoese, Florentines, Venetians, Lucchese, Sienese, all of them made their mark at different times and places between about 1200 and 1500. When King Edward I of England, the Longshanks, the bad guy in Braveheart, needed a loan to fight his incessant wars, he turned to the Ricciardi bankers of Lucca. When Isabella of Castile was looking to finance Christopher Columbus's first voyage, she turned to Genoese financiers. When Charles the Bold of Burgundy needed money to fight the Swiss, he turned to the Medici of Florence. When merchants needed to transfer funds from place to place or took out a commercial loan, they used the bill of exchange, another Italian invention. Double-entry bookkeeping and accounting in general was another Italian invention. It's not just that Italians dominated banking. They had essentially invented it. But around 1470, something happened. All of the big Italian banking houses ran into trouble. Credit got tight. Princes defaulted on their loans. Margins grew slimmer. Amid a general economic downturn, some of the most successful banking families in Europe went belly up. Last week, we talked about the rise and fall of the Medici Bank, one of the dominant financial institutions of the 15th century. By 1490, it was a spent force, and a few years later, it crashed completely. It wasn't alone. Italian banking would eventually come back to life, but things would never be the same. The dominant position of the Italians was gone for good. The landscape in 1500 looked much different than it had 30 years before. A new group of bankers emerged, the South Germans. Quite suddenly, within a single generation, the center of the European financial world moved hundreds of miles north of the Alps. Cities like Nuremberg and Augsburg were the centers of banking in this new arrangement. South German merchants and financiers popped up in every new market and emerging industry at the beginning of the 16th century. Their hard-headed mentality dominated the next 100 years of business. Of those South Germans, the most important firm came from Augsburg. It had existed for generations, but right around 1500, it blew up into an institution of international importance. Its head was a man named Jakob Fugger. One recent author has called him the richest man who ever lived. While that's a great title for a book, the statement probably wasn't true. But Fugger did get incredibly wealthy by exploiting every trade opportunity that popped up across a rapidly changing Europe. The new Portuguese trade with India, the Antwerp financial market, state finance, and mining. Fugger and his firm had fingers or whole hands in all of those pies. He was the man who bought the title of Holy Roman Emperor for Charles V, the most powerful ruler of this entire period. His financing arrangements set off Martin Luther's tirade on indulgences, the 95 Theses, which launched the Protestant Reformation. Safe to say, Jakob Fugger was a pretty important guy. He wasn't an especially charismatic one. He patronized artistic creation, but nothing too flashy. He donated to charity, but not too much. He rubbed elbows with emperors and popes, but said little that's gone down in the history books. He was basically the stock character of the hard-headed, sharp, and ruthless merchant prince. So focusing on Jakob alone commits a great crime that we see in a lot of writing on business leaders of the present and the past, from Steve Jobs to John D. Rockefeller. This crime is treating the deeds of individual visionaries as the end-all explanation for both individual success and broader economic change. Today, we're going to take a different approach. Jakob Fugger will be here. He'll get plenty of attention. But more than that, he and especially his family will be our entry point to a shifting world of banking and finance. For most of the Middle Ages, banking had been a fringe thing for international merchants and city dwellers and the occasional cash-strapped king. Important in its way, but not essential to a mostly rural and agricultural system. Fugger and the South Germans brought finance right to the center of the European economy. Let's find out how. All of that starts with understanding South Germany in this age. We've seen Germany a few times on Tides. Way back at the beginning when we talked about Landsknecht mercenaries and the military revolution, again with Maximilian and the Habsburgs a couple of months back, and then a few weeks ago in the context of Europe as a whole in 1492. But we really need to dig in here to an area we've mostly neglected. How and why, all of a sudden, did this stretch of territory start to produce impossibly wealthy and well-run merchant banking firms? A note here. For what follows, I'm largely drawing on a fine book by the German historian Mark Haberlein called The Fuggers of Augsburg. So for most of the Middle Ages, the southern part of Germany was kind of a backwater. It didn't have the great cities of the Low Countries or northern Italy, the easy communications and trade route of the Rhineland, the exceptional agricultural potential or the intense chivalric culture of northern France, or the political centralization or sophistication of England. But South Germany wasn't desperately poor either. It had its cities, namely Augsburg and Nuremberg. There was good agricultural land suited to grain and vineyards and hops. As part of the Holy Roman Empire, its politics were confusing and complicated, but it wasn't a constant war zone. Sitting between northern Italy and the Rhineland, it was centrally located. There was potential here. Under the right circumstances, the whole region could blossom. Those circumstances showed up in the aftermath of the Black Death. The plague hit the cities of the region hard, but recovery was fast. After about 1350, the textile industry boomed in southern Germany. It had already been going for a while. Augsburg's tax records show that it was a major concern as early as 1276, but it got much, much bigger. Specifically, a new product called fustian, a heavy cloth made from a mixture of wool and cotton, was responsible for that boom. Fustian was a genuine innovation in this period. It was durable and it was comfortable, and it could be used for a wide variety of garments and purposes. After the Black Death, when people had a little more money to spend than they had in the pinched years before the plague, this was a particularly viable industry. There was a lot of money to be made, but weaving fustian required an infrastructure. Long-distance traders to import the raw materials, especially cotton, the provision of credit for the weavers to buy the raw materials, and merchants to gather up, market, and sell the finished products over a wide area. The fustian business took off all over southern Germany, Nordlingen, Constance, Ulm, and especially Augsburg. Weavers' guilds sprouted up all over the place, taking in new members and rising to prominence in their home cities. It wasn't just the cities either. Much of the actual cloth production was outsourced to the countryside, where peasants took the raw materials, produced it, and then returned it to the merchants who sold it. But the cities were where the action was, and they pulled in large numbers of rural migrants. In the year 1367, one of those rural migrants showed up in the city of Augsburg. He had come from the small village of Graben, 20 miles to the south of the city, trekking through the fertile farmland and scattered woodlands that separated his home from opportunity. The man's name was Hans Fugger. Like so many of those migrants, he was a weaver by trade. He made good in his new home. Before long, he was paying quite a bit in taxes. Two marriages, both to daughters of future masters of the Guild of Weavers, helped raise his status. By 1386, Hans Fugger was a member of the Weavers Guild's leadership committee, and the city council as well. He bought a house in Augsburg, where his brother Uhlen lived with him. Uhlen was not as fortunate as Hans. He was murdered in 1394, and his descendants disappear from the records within a few decades. But Hans Fugger kept on rising. In 1396, his property was worth the substantial sum of 1,806 florins, which made him the 40th wealthiest citizen of Augsburg. We don't know exactly how Hans Fugger made his money, but it's hard to believe it was just by working really extra hard at his loom. Augsburg had lots of weavers. Most of them weren't in the city's top 1% of earners. Hans must have been playing some kind of role as a merchant middleman. It would be a logical step for a smart and ambitious weaver with good social connections to make the leap into raw materials and distribution. This was where the real money was for most of Augsburg's elite. Hans died in 1408 or 1409. His widow, Elizabeth, survived for almost three decades more. She and Hans had two sons, Andreas and Jakob, who was apprenticed to a goldsmith, another lucrative and highly respectable trade. We don't know exactly what the family was up to business-wise during these years, but the three of them were all assessed together for tax purposes under Elizabeth's name. It stands to reason that she had real input into or direction over the family's business activities, which must have been substantial. Whatever they were doing, it worked. The value of the family property more than doubled between Hans's death and Elizabeth's in 1436. Again, we know very little about the specifics, but Elizabeth must have had serious talent to keep things moving forward. Starting in 1441, we can get more direct insight into what Andreas and Jakob were up to. They were still in business together, which we know because their property was jointly assessed for taxation. The brothers were doing some sort of long-distance trade. We know this because they were censured by Augsburg's city council for dodging some toll payments in 1442, which suggests that they were moving large amounts of goods. They must have done well because they shared the fifth largest estate in the city in 1448. But after that, Andreas and Jakob parted ways. Maybe they had a falling out. We don't know. What's certain is that the two brothers each went into business on their own and founded two separate family lines and firms. The first of these, Andreas and his descendants, became known as the Fuggers vom Reh, of the Roe Deer, which was on their coat of arms. They had a good run. They got very rich from trade before branching out into banking and finance. They had operations all over Europe. Milan, Venice, Nuremberg, Frankfurt, the Low Countries. But they ran into trouble in the 1490s and were completely bankrupt by 1500. Between Andreas and Jakob, Jakob's family line and firm was both luckier and better at business. These were the Fuggers von der Lilly, the Fuggers of the Lilies, so named for the lilies on the family coat of arms. The Fuggers von der Lilly didn't rise nearly as fast as their cousins. In fact, they almost didn't get off the ground in the first place. Jakob, later to be known as Jakob the Elder, to distinguish him from his much, much more famous son, had been apprenticed to a rich goldsmith named Basinger and married his daughter. But old Basinger the goldsmith went bankrupt, and Jakob the Elder was stuck with some of his debts just to maintain the family's social standing. There was nothing worse for a merchant or financier in this period than bankruptcy. For people who dealt in money, and especially in trust, bankruptcy meant extreme dishonor and maybe even social death. Nobody wanted to associate with someone in that position. The stain wasn't limited to the person immediately responsible for the bankruptcy. But Jakob the Elder escaped this disaster and slowly built his business and a reputation for extreme probity and trustworthiness. Over the next 25 years, he rose to leadership of the Weavers Guild and did a lot of long-distance trade before he died in 1469. As with Jakob's mother, his widow kept the family property together and actively managed it well into her son's adulthood. Those sons proved to be talented and capable. Three of them stand out: Ulrich, Georg, and Jakob the Younger. It was their joint business, beginning after their father's death in 1469, that would make the Fuggers both famous and impossibly wealthy.
If you travel for work, you know to pack two suits, business and swim. You know, with your Delta SkyMiles Business Amex card, buying that plane ticket for a business trip can get you closer to medallion status. You know that a meeting in Montana means visiting almost every national park.
Yellowstone? Check.
Because you're the chief excursion officer. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum Business American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you know business.
If you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of the hunt. But are you getting the thrill of the best deals? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Urban Outfitters, Fenty Beauty, and Expedia. And even stack sales on top of cash back. It's easy to use and you get your cash back through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten.
The Fugger brothers all went into business together in the family firm. Ulrich, Georg, and Jakob the Younger are the ones we know, but they also had several other brothers. Andreas, Hans, and Peter all died young. There was another brother, Marx, who became a cleric in Rome and directed a fair bit of church business in the family's direction before he too died young. But Ulrich, Georg, and Jakob are the keys to understanding how the Fuggers von der Lilly got so rich. That is the story we'll trace. Practically all medieval businesses were a family affair. This isn't surprising or unique to that period or even now. About 90% of American businesses today are family businesses. Anybody who's ever tried to run a business knows that you need to trust your partners and your employees. There's no better guarantee of trust than family ties. This was especially true in an economic environment where the formal institutions of accountability were a lot weaker than they are today, as they were in the Middle Ages. If we want to understand the Fuggers and their ridiculous success, we need to understand how a merchant family and their business actually worked. Merchant families belonged to a specific social world, the world of an urban elite where business and family relations were completely inseparable. It wouldn't have even occurred to the Fuggers or their contemporaries that it was possible to separate them, or that separating them would be a good thing. For that matter, medieval people didn't treat the individual as the fundamental unit of society. That's another major contrast with our own world. For them, the family, the kin group, was the basic building block. So from the very beginning, the assumption was that Ulrich, Georg, and Jakob the Younger would all work together to further the interests of the family. This has some major implications for the structure of their firm and how they did business, and for all South German merchant bankers. At the time of their father's death in 1469, Jakob was only 10, Georg was 16, and Ulrich was 28. All of them went to work for the family firm at a young age. When Jakob was 14 in 1473, he went to Venice to begin his commercial apprenticeship. Two of his brothers had died there, but Jakob was luckier. Precisely what the Fuggers' business in Venice was is hard to suss out, but it presumably had something to do with the long-distance cloth trade. We can surmise that in Venice, Jakob benefited from being on the cutting edge of late medieval business practices. Commercial law, sailing insurance, money transfers and loans, the volatile commodities markets, and above all, accounting. There was no better place for an up-and-coming young merchant to be than Venice, and Jakob stayed there until the early 1480s. There's an old tradition that says Jakob was destined for the priesthood. He did have a clerical benefice in his name, meaning he owned the revenue from a parish, but that was just another smart investment for a diversified family business. By 1479, when Jakob resigned that benefice for good, his path in life was already clear. He was a merchant, and before long, he would prove to be an unusually gifted one. That apprenticeship in Venice was key. By the middle of the 1480s, when we get more information on how the brothers Fugger had structured their business, it's clear that Jakob owned the southern trade. The axis that stretched from Augsburg to Innsbruck in Austria, then over the Alps to Venice, and from Venice out to the wider world, that was Jakob's specialty. By 1484, the Fuggers were a big enough deal to have their own chamber in the Fondaco dei Tedeschi, the House of German Merchants in Venice. Previously, that chamber had belonged to the merchant consortium of an entire town in the Tyrol. That's a hint to the scale of their business in Venice, and it was Jakob's purview. The other two brothers had their own responsibilities. Georg lived in Nuremberg, from where he handled central and eastern Germany with the aid of some trusted associates. Ulrich was based in Augsburg, where he kept watch over the whole operation and maintained the social and political connections that were vital to the firm's business. Advantageous marriages were one big piece of that. The Augsburg business elite was a tight-knit group. Remember, the brothers' mother was the daughter of a wealthy goldsmith and merchant. Their grandmother was the daughter of the master of the Weavers' Guild. Ulrich, the eldest, married the daughter of the master of the Salt Traders Guild. Georg married a daughter of one of Augsburg's richest merchants. The Fugger sisters also all married members of the merchant elite. This kind of thing was the norm all across Europe, in Florence and London and Bruges and Strasbourg, for a good reason. In an indirect sense, belonging to this tightly knit elite created opportunities to further the family business. Advantageous marriages helped draw the Fuggers into exclusive social organizations, like the Gentlemen's Drinking Hall, where Augsburg's elite gathered to socialize. Then, as now, business was all about relationships. Relationships with people who might invest in a venture, who could leverage a political connection, and who could open doors or close them for competitors. The Fuggers weren't the most active or important family in city politics, but they were connected to people who were, and that was helpful too. In a basic sense, these marriages helped increase the Fugger family's social capital. They got more prestigious within their own domain, which had major knock-on effects on their business. But marriage and rising up the social ladder had more direct effects on business too. Family ties were also business ties, and marriages created durable relationships. Those relationships often included direct investment in business ventures. In other words, they increased the liquid capital available to firms like the Fuggers. The property a woman from a wealthy family brought into a marriage was immediately available for large-scale ventures. Again, this wasn't just true in Augsburg. The historian Barbara Hanawalt wrote a great book called The Wealth of Wives about how this played out in late medieval London, for example. but we can trace it with unusual clarity with the Fuggers. Their business grew drastically over the 1480s, in large part thanks to the investment capital from their wives and their wives' families. Of the three brothers, only Jakob remained unmarried. So what exactly were the Fuggers and their business up to in the middle of the 1480s? Well, we know they were still doing a lot of large-scale cloth trading. We know they had interests over a wide area, including Milan, Nuremberg, and obviously Venice, where Jakob had spent more than a decade. They did some small-scale financial transactions, including a couple for the city of Augsburg and more for the church. But the real turning point came between about 1485 and 1490. I mentioned a moment ago that the Fuggers had started to branch out into small-scale financial transactions. In 1485, they made their first substantial loan. It was to Archduke Sigismund of Tyrol, a member of the Habsburg dynasty. Tyrol was an Alpine region. Today, it spans a little bit of northern Italy and a little bit of southern Austria, and it was centered on the city of Innsbruck. Now, Archduke Sigismund was perpetually short on cash and not a particularly accomplished ruler. His major achievements at this point were double-crossing Charles the Bold of Burgundy and running up enormous debts. He owed 60,000 florins to the director of Tyrol's financial administration. That was just one of many large outstanding sums. The Fuggers loaned him only 3,000 florins, a relatively small amount, but this mattered for two major reasons. First, it was the beginning of the Fuggers' special relationship with the Habsburg dynasty, which would be the major source of their wealth and power moving forward. Second, the Fuggers didn't charge interest on this 3,000 florins. Instead, they took their repayment in silver. This was the beginning of the Fuggers' interest in mining, the second pillar of their soon-to-be enormous wealth. This wasn't a coincidence. Tyrol was right on the way to Venice, where the Fuggers had substantial business interests, so they knew the region well. More importantly, they knew it was currently in the midst of a mining boom. So was Europe more generally, something we'll come back to in just a moment. Basically, with the loan to Sigismund, the Fuggers saw an opening to slide into an emerging field at an early point with very little risk. They made the loan, and they got a guaranteed security. An order from Sigismund for 1,000 marks, 281 kilograms, of silver from a Tyrolean mining operator named Christian Tenzel. The transaction worked out beautifully. When Sigismund needed more money to fight a war with Venice in 1487-88, the Fuggers advanced him 14,500 florins, then 8,000 more. Again, they secured the loans with deliveries of silver, and everything went smoothly. There was an even larger opportunity here, if it could be seized. On June 9, 1488, just months after those other loans, the Fuggers advanced Sigismund the staggering sum of 150,000 florins. In return, the Fuggers were to receive the entire production of a major silver mine, the mine at Schwaz. This is all a bit complicated, but bear with me. The Fuggers weren't getting their silver for free. They paid a fixed price for it, of which a portion went to the smelter of the mines and another portion went back to the Fuggers themselves to pay back the loan. So their purchase price, theoretically, also paid them back. A fixed amount of the silver they bought had to go to the Archduke's mints to be minted into fine silver coinage. But, and here's the genius of the plan, any surplus silver produced by the mine was the Fuggers to sell on the open market. Their profit came from the difference between the low, fixed price they paid for the silver and the actual going rate for the metal on the European market, which was generally much, much higher. This was an immediate success. It generated huge profits. And Sigismund needed still more cash, which the Fuggers were happy to provide. In return, they got still more silver from smelting works in Innsbruck, from another mining complex, and then they got coinage fresh from the mint as well. The Fuggers were going big time. When Archduke Sigismund was forced out of Tyrol and Austria in 1490 and replaced by his cousin Maximilian, whom we've met, the Fuggers continued the relationship. By doing so, they hitched themselves to Europe's up-and-coming dynasty. It was a sharp calculation. Maximilian was the son of the Holy Roman Emperor and almost sure to succeed his father. As we talked about a few months back, he had married the heiress of the Duchy of Burgundy, Mary, and ruled there while his son, Philip the Handsome, was coming of age. Maximilian had extensive lands. They were getting more extensive now that he'd acquired Tyrol and Austria, and he was always on the lookout for more. The soon-to-be emperor was personally brave, he was a pretty decent soldier, and above all, he was a sharp, amoral politician. If you were a member of an up-and-coming firm like the Fuggers, Maximilian looked like a pretty great bet. Before long, the Fuggers were in deep with Maximilian. 120,000 florins in 1491, another 120,000 in 1492, and still more loans in the following years. That money paid for soldiers and diplomatic missions. It bought off delegates at treaty negotiations. It paid for Maximilian's second wedding and bought back territory that he'd had to mortgage. In return for all of it, the Fuggers got silver, silver, and still more silver. Between 1485 and 1494, according to one estimate, the Fuggers advanced Sigismund and Maximilian 624,000 florins. That same estimate suggests that the Fuggers made more than 400,000 florins of profit on those advances. Now, 400,000 florins is probably a bit too high, but it's in the ballpark. The Fuggers made literal tons of money on these transactions. So, in short order, the Fugger brothers, Ulrich, Georg, and Jakob, had transformed themselves from long-distance traders, mostly in cloth, to some of the biggest financiers in Europe. It's worth briefly going over the mechanics of it. The Fuggers were already long-distance merchants in 1485, and by any metric, very prosperous ones. This means they had a lot of liquid capital at their disposal, but still, nowhere near the sums they would soon be lending to Sigismund and Maximilian. Where did the rest come from? In large part, it came from something we talked about earlier, their family, social, and business ties in Augsburg. They took deposits from patricians and wealthy merchants, presumably their in-laws, who were all rich traders of one kind or another. In other words, the Fuggers mobilized their social networks for capital. It's also possible that they took money from influential political figures in Innsbruck, but this was secondary. One of the characteristic features of the South German firms like the Fuggers was their extreme preference for keeping their business associations very close, preferably in the family. Nothing about the Fuggers' activities to this point was especially innovative. Their in-laws, the Meuting family of merchants, had made loans to Archduke Sigismund way back in the 1450s, again secured by silver. There were many other Augsburg merchant families who had done the same kind of long-distance trade. The Meutings, to stick with the same example, had business ties in Venice, Genoa, and Bruges, and they were hardly unique. There was nothing particularly complex about the structure of the Fuggers firm or their accounting practices. In fact, the Fuggers probably didn't even use double-entry bookkeeping. But two things made the Fuggers stand out. First, they, or maybe just Jakob, an emerging genius as a businessman, understood the broader context. I mean, really grasped the big picture. I mentioned the mining boom in Tyrol a little while ago. This meant that there was much firmer security to make much larger loans to whomever, Sigismund or Maximilian, owned those silver mines. It was just a much safer bet. The Fuggers understood the intricacies of the European metal market. As long as the silver kept flowing, so too would their profits. The second thing that made the Fuggers stand out was tied to the first, an understanding of scale. As long as they could raise the necessary capital, there was no fundamental difference in the size of the loans they were making or the amount of silver they were taking in. All they needed was the willingness to take the risk and manage the increasing size of the enterprise. The Fugger brothers, led by Jakob, were more than ready to make that bet. It paid off.
If you travel, you know how to pull off a perfect getaway. You know, after you enroll with your Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card, you get up to $10 back monthly on U.S. rideshare purchases with select providers, like a car to the airport. You know which remote retreats have the best herbal baths and where the Wi-Fi password is rarely used, because you're the escape artist. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Purchases must be on card. Visit go.amex/you know.
Having precious little Jakob Fugger in a podcast episode that's ostensibly about him is an intentional choice. Jakob wasn't particularly interesting as a character. He married late and had no children. He patronized artists and he collected some incredibly expensive gems and jewelry, but he wasn't particularly flashy. With all that said, Jakob Fugger was a heck of a businessman. He really was a talent, maybe even a genius, who happened to find himself in the perfect situation to make the most of his gifts. The years up to 1494, what we focused on so far, provided that situation. But in 1494, a couple of important things happened. First, the brothers Fugger remade their firm. On August 18th of that year, the three signed a six-year contract that formally defined their business as Ulrich Fugger and Brothers of Augsburg. It included specific rules on capital investment, withdrawals, and what rights other family members had over the firm's capital, and generally brought them up to speed with prevailing practice among South German firms. The six-year contract was normal. The Medici had done business the same way with each individual partnership contract. On paper, all three brothers were equal. Ulrich, as the eldest, even got his name on the company. But what was clear, and what would become even clearer in the 1502 and 1510 contracts that continued the business, was that Jakob was emerging as the leader. Later in 1494, the Fuggers expanded their mining interests in both silver and another good, copper. They signed a contract with a mining engineer named Hans Thurso, who was leasing some mines in present-day Slovakia, then part of the Kingdom of Hungary. This was a straightforward financing and distribution agreement. It was actually run separately, with separate contracts, from the family firm proper. The Fuggers put up the cash, Thurso ran the operation, the Fuggers distributed the goods, and everybody profited. Shortly after, the Fuggers got in deeper. They picked up a lead mine and they built their own additional smelting works, hammer mills, and all sorts of other facilities. This was a perfect embodiment of the changing context that Jakob and his brothers took advantage of. The whole operation was built on a new mining process, the Siger process, which was effective but also required high capital investment to get off the ground. The Fuggers had capital to spare, and the results were wildly profitable. The Fugger's mining complex at Neusol was an enormous operation. It pumped out silver and copper in mind-boggling quantities. To market and sell the products of their mining business, the Fuggers built a huge distribution network all across Europe. Part of the metal went north, first to cities like Krakow and Leipzig for distribution inland, and then second to ports on the Baltic, from where much of it was eventually shipped west to the emerging market of Antwerp. From Antwerp, it went to France, England, and the rest of Europe. The other major route went south, to Venice, another key distribution point. All of this required new offices and salesmen at key points, and that meant adding hundreds of employees. Through this mining and distribution network, the Fuggers controlled somewhere around 40% of European copper output. The profits from the combined silver and copper trade ran into hundreds of thousands or even millions of florins over the course of the following decade. Mining was the core of the Fuggers' business interests. It was their bread and butter, and it brought them huge amounts of liquid capital through the sale of silver and copper on the open market. But it was also deeply connected to their other activities. The loans to Sigismund and Maximilian had given them Tyrolean silver in the first place. Close connections to the court of the Kingdom of Hungary, where their Neusol complex was located, kept their mining investments safe and profitable. The church constantly required banking services to transfer money around its vast and widely dispersed holdings. Money from France, Germany, and the Low Countries to Rome, profits from indulgent sales in Lorraine, crusading subsidies from Rome to Hungary transferred through the Fugger's office in Venice. This wasn't a particularly large business when compared with mining, but it was important beyond its financial impact. The papacy was a major political player, and having a good relationship meant help when the Fuggers' business interests were threatened. When the Hanseatic city of Lübeck impounded Fugger copper, the full force of the papacy and their close associate Maximilian, by then Holy Roman Emperor, fell on the city. The Fuggers got their copper back, and future shipments went through Lübeck safely. In other words, the Fuggers could call on the highest political and spiritual authorities of their day in what amounted to a business dispute. Georg Fugger died in 1506 and Ulrich in 1510, leaving Jakob alone as the head of the firm. Now, the deaths of his two brothers drastically affect how we think of Jakob and the whole business. Jakob took firm control in the aftermath. He cut out his nephews, Anton and Raymond, the sons of Georg, from management except on very specific terms. Because of this, it's easy to treat the business's success as Jakob's doing. It wasn't. He had played a major role in a couple of things. It's safe to surmise that the loans to Sigismund and Maximilian and the security in Tyrolean silver were probably his doing. We can see him as the leading figure in managing those interests from the late 1480s on. The large-scale distribution of goods through Venice was likewise his purview. Jakob's experience in Venice, one of the most advanced business environments in Europe, may have made the firm's management more efficient. We know Jakob did a lot of personal auditing of the firm's books and accounts, and he traveled widely to the branch offices. But at the same time, we know that other pieces were his brother's doing. Ulrich and Georg built the wide geographic scope of the firm, from Italy in the south to Poland and Hungary in the east and the Low Countries in the west. Ulrich had actually been the first of the family to extend credit to a Habsburg. Ulrich and Georg had begun doing business with the papacy while Jakob was still a teenaged apprentice. Ulrich and Georg had expanded the firm's purview from common textiles into silk, spices, and high-value trade goods. In other words, the Fuggers' beginnings as financiers and their distribution network, which they would exploit so beautifully, all predated Jakob's active management of the firm. The historian Jakob Strieder, writing almost a century ago, pointed out that if not for Jakob's long period of sole management, Ulrich Fugger probably would have been the famous one. But Ulrich and Georg died, and Jakob took ruthless control over the whole operation. In many respects, the Fugger firm had been typical of South German styles of organization. It was a family business, organized as a partnership. It was maybe a bit more centralized and concentrated than most, with management in the sole hands of the three brothers rather than a more extended family group, but this was still within the normal bounds. This changed after Ulrich and Georg's deaths. Although the company was formally renamed Jakob Fugger and his brother's sons after his brothers died, Jakob took over sole management. This wasn't normal. There were practically no other South German firms or firms anywhere else in Europe of this size or scale, anywhere close to it, that were run as sole proprietorships. The period of Jakob's sole control was a time of meteoric growth for the firm. Its assets increased 10 times from 1510 to 1525. According to one estimate, it controlled perhaps 2% of Europe's entire GDP at the end of Jakob's life. This is the source of the richest man who ever lived line, by the way, though I'm sure you can see the fallacy in equating a massive international firm's assets with one man's personal wealth. Now, it's almost impossible to give a full accounting of the firm's activities. It had too many offices and too many different interests, and that was getting to be the case even before the deaths of Georg and Ulrich. Instead of trying to list them all, let's just go over the major areas and how they fed into broader shifts in the European economy and society. So first we have mining. We've already talked about that, but it bears repeating because it was the foundation of the Fuggers' wealth. Without ever achieving a full monopoly, despite their best efforts, they had effectively cornered the European copper market. Copper was an essential material for casting bronze cannon in an age of almost continuous gunpowder warfare. On top of that, the Fuggers got vast amounts of silver from the Tyrol and as a byproduct of their copper smelting business. Silver was pretty valuable as the basis for the everyday coinage that everybody used across the continent. The amounts of both metals they refined, distributed, and sold were simply mind-boggling. Their distribution network required sizable offices in Venice and Antwerp, and routes stretching the length and breadth of Europe. It's hard to say precisely how great their profits were, but they were well north of a million florins in the first two decades of the 16th century, and potentially much, much higher than that. Second, we have state finance. This wasn't entirely separate from mining. Remember, the Fuggers had gotten their first Tyrolean silver mines as security for loans first to Sigismund and then to Maximilian. They got other securities, again based in rights to mines or favorable contracts for the sale of metals in return for other loans. In 1515, for example, the Fuggers and another Augsburg firm, the Hückstädters, formed a consortium to loan a huge amount of money to Maximilian. In return, the consortium received exclusive rights to the entire copper output of the Schwarz mines in the Tyrol. We're talking about money in the hundreds of thousands of florins, enough to fund entire wars. In 1519, the amounts of money got even bigger. Old Maximilian finally died, but the Fuggers' relationship with the House of Habsburg was just beginning. Maximilian's successor was his grandson, Charles V, who was already king of Spain as the grandson of Isabella and Ferdinand. Charles, naturally, wanted to succeed his other grandfather as Holy Roman Emperor, but that was an elective position. The votes would have to be bought. It wouldn't come cheap. King Henry VIII of England and King Francis I of France were both active candidates, and Francis succeeded in getting pledges for votes from two of the seven electors. This meant that at least four of the others would need to be bought, and they demanded a ridiculous price. 851,918 florins, of which Jakob Fugger provided two-thirds. His firm handled the bills of exchange for the remainder, which came from another German firm and three Italian companies. This act made Jakob Fugger famous, almost single-handedly financing the election of the most powerful political figure of the 16th century. In return, Jakob once again received huge mining concessions in the form of direct ownership of mining and smelting operations in the Tyrol. This was good, solid security for more than 600,000 florins of outstanding loans, an absolutely staggering sum. The relationship with the Habsburgs continued for decades on after this point, to the point where Jakob's nephew and successor Anton was even more tightly bound to them both politically and financially. Some historians have called Anton the quote-unquote court factor, as if he were a specialist provider of services to the Habsburgs, and that's not entirely wrong. Now, third, on top of state finance, we have banking more generally. It's common to call the Fuggers a banking house, but that was only a minor part of what they actually did, especially when compared with the Medici operation that we looked at last week. The Fuggers took deposits, sure, but those deposits were mostly from close associates or key political figures, like court officials or cardinals of the church. In that sense, deposits were more a means of raising capital from trusted folks or a concierge service for the influential than the actual basis of the firm's activities. With that said, the tools of banking were essential to what the Fugger firm actually did. Remember, we're talking about handling and moving enormous amounts of money. Profits from sales of copper in Antwerp or Venice. Investments in the India trade in Lisbon. Debits on purchases of silver in the Tyrol. Payments for shipping services and road maintenance in the Alps. Transfers of money to pay Habsburg mercenaries in northern Italy or the Rhineland. Letters of credit for diplomats in Paris or Naples. Pooling and transferring the profits from the sale of indulgences in Saxony, that incident that set off Martin Luther. All of these things required banking services, like drawing up letters of credit and bills of exchange, and making book transfers, where money went from account to account with the stroke of a pen and no physical currency. The Fuggers also played the money markets. They made loans and changed currency at favorable rates, and when necessary, they took out short-term loans to get liquid capital. Even a firm as rich as Jakob Fugger's didn't always have the capital on hand to meet the voracious needs of the Habsburgs. Short-term borrowing and repayment was a basic part of what the firm did. That, too, required deep involvement in banking. Finally, the Fuggers were merchants. This is something we talked about at length last week, but it bears repeating. Scratch a banker and you'll find a merchant, and vice versa. The Fuggers specialized in the metal trade, but that was still trade, albeit on an enormous scale and geographic scope that required a massive organization. Branch offices, employees, trusted associates, reliable and influential political contacts, easy ways of moving money over long distances, access to short-term credit, and so on. In other words, the Fuggers had a network that stretched all over Europe. That network was specially tuned for the metal trade and state finance, but it could be, and was, used for a vast array of other things. If they wanted to speculate on the spices imported by the Portuguese from India, they could do that. If they wanted to invest in a Spanish expedition to the Moluccas, clear beyond India, they could do that too. If they wanted to turn a profit on luxury cloths, they could do that. The pieces were always in place. With all of this in mind, let's finish up by understanding the effect of the rise of the German bankers. After all, the Fuggers were far from the only South German firm to leap onto the European scene around 1500. The same conditions that Jakob Fugger and his brothers exploited so productively were fertile ground for many others as well. The Welsers and the Höchstädters were other Augsburg families that became fabulously wealthy in this period on the same basis as the Fuggers. Mining, state finance, banking, long-distance trade. They too were spread out all across Europe. One historian even calls the new system that emerged after about 1500, quote, banking without bankers, simply because the South German firms were so diversified. Their attitude toward capital and business in general was a bit different than their Italian predecessors. They were a bit more grounded, a bit keener on pure profit, always looking for guaranteed returns on investment, particularly in mining and the farming of state revenues. In other words, to put it bluntly, they were a little more ruthlessly capitalistic. Now, it's easy to overstate this and make the Germans the forerunners of modern industrial capitalism. This wasn't the case. They were really concerned with family honor and social standing, not just the ultra-rational pursuit of profits. But the pursuit of ever greater profits was actually built into those conceptions of family honor and social standing in inseparable ways for the Germans. There were major long-term effects to the rise of the South Germans. First and foremost was the mining boom and the influx of investment capital from firms like the Fuggers that made that boom possible, since the new techniques of mining all required tons of money to get up and going. The huge amounts of silver flowing into European pockets was the beginning of what's called the price revolution, a long-term process of monetary inflation that remade the European economy from top to bottom. Silver from the New World eventually became the biggest contributing factor to the price revolution, but it all began with the silver mines of the Tyrol and elsewhere from South German investment capital. The price revolution eventually touched every European, from the humblest peasant to the highest king, and it all began with the Fuggers and their investments. Second, the basic geography of European commerce and finance shifted. Bruges had been the major money market of medieval Europe, the cradle of capitalism, according to one economic historian. But it fell hard at the end of the 15th century. Its fall was closely associated with the decline of the Italian firms like the Medici. Now, Antwerp, another city in the Low Countries, replaced Bruges as the major money market after 1500. The Germans were already established in Antwerp because of the city's importance to their long-distance cloth trade through the North Sea. It was no trouble at all for the Germans to convert their commercial network into a financial one. The Fuggers turned Antwerp into the major distribution point for their copper and did business in loans and credit there as well. The rise of Antwerp is the single most important event in the financial history of the 16th century. Its money market was far more sophisticated and did much larger business than Bruges ever had. The Germans were established in Antwerp from the beginning and exploited that position. It wasn't just Antwerp. The Fuggers and the other South German firms showed up in every other emerging market as well, especially Spain. Now, it's not like the Italians ignored Spain. We've seen how Florentines and especially Genoese financed Columbus, and Genoese bankers would become key to Spanish state financing in the 16th century. But the South Germans established themselves strongly from an early date, and the Fugger firm was Charles V's most important creditor. As a result, they had huge interests in Spanish estates and tax revenues. Other German firms, not so much the Fuggers, were active in the brand new overseas markets. This meant a presence in Lisbon, and then Antwerp again when the Portuguese spice trade moved there. The third and final long-term effect of the rise of the German bankers was political. They directly enabled the quote-unquote rise of the state we've spent so much time talking about here, because they paid for so much of what states wanted to do, namely making war. Maximilian and Charles V fought constantly. Fighting was expensive, and the South Germans were willing to pay for it in the short term in return for long-term securities. Even if they were mostly lending to the Habsburgs, the other rulers of the age were forced to take out loans and develop their financial systems to keep up. This was the beginning of a new age of warfare and state building. Every time an army of mercenaries looted and burned some poor village or sacked a city, every time the cannons boomed and walls crumbled, we can thank some Augsburg cloth merchants who decided to branch out. If we want to get specific, we can thank Jakob Fugger. Next time on Tides, we're going to head back south of the Alps to explore a fascinating place, Renaissance Italy, where labyrinthine backstabbing politics created modern diplomacy and state finance in a never-ending round of wars and negotiations. After that, we'll be talking about the colorful condottieri, the professional mercenaries who defined the late Middle Ages in Italy. Until then, thanks so much for joining. Be sure and drop me a line if you'd like to chat about the fall of the Roman Empire or the rise of the modern world. You can find me on Twitter at @Patrick_Wyman or on Facebook at @PatrickWymanMMA. You can follow the show at Tides History. Tides of History is written and narrated by me, Patrick Wyman. The sound design is by Derek Behrens for Airship. The sound engineer is Sergio Enriquez. Tides of History is produced by Morgan Jaffe and Leah Sutherland. From Wondery, the executive producer is Hernan Lopez. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, from Wondery, this has been Tides of History.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.